We noted that, we noted two lawyers were arguing this two cases on the same day, and there was one significant common issue. Each case seemed to have a separate issue, so we thought you could get the common issue handled efficiently, and then you can point out when you, when you're talking only about one case or the other on something else.
I think this works out wonderfully, Your Honor. May it please the court. My name is Dan Goldberg, and I represent Glenn Harlow and Thomas Boas in this appeal. As this court has acknowledged already, they present a similar issue, and I think consolidating the oral argument was a wise decision. The government has referred to the issue as identical, and I do think there are some distinct contours, as Judge Loken just referred to. But what I'd like to do is start with Mr. Harlow's appeal, because I think it's a helpful vehicle to illustrating why both cases are entitled to appellate relief. The district court erred in failing to grant full relief on Mr. Harlow's Section 2255 motion after concluding that his sentence, in part, was, quote, an illegal sentence after Johnson, end quote. The only relief granted Mr. Harlow was modifying his term of supervised release from 5 years to 3 years, which, of course, was the correct thing to do. But what the district court did not do was modify his term of imprisonment, which was improper because that, too, is an illegal and unconstitutional sentence because it was predicated on the void residual clause and exceeded the statutory maximum of 120 months. The government concedes this much, but goes on to argue that any error was, in essence, harmless because the district court could have sentenced him to the same sentence by running the terms consecutively. I think there's two problems with this argument. One is legally, and second, I think, is just looking at the sentencing transcript, the original sentencing transcript. At that original sentencing transcript, I think you see that the district court would have sentenced him to a different sentence without the ACCA designation. On two occasions, the district court stated that it was, quote, required to impose the statutory minimum of 180 months. And in fact, that's what they sentenced him too was the bare minimum sentence of 180 months. I think the other interesting feature.
Well, you're taking this as a look back question. I don't think the alternative sentence decision determination is a look back. It doesn't matter what you know, that how he would have gotten there before, or what would the components. Question is under the correct sentencing landscape now, without the, you know, the Armed Career Criminal Act, what would I have done? And he was telling us, I thought quite clearly, I would have done the same thing, obviously by a different route.
I think
that's that. Our case law says that's the way you do this, district courts.
I think it's a very astute observation, Your Honor. I think you're absolutely right. The district court did say he would have done it all over again. I don't know if he failed to refer back to his original sentencing transcript. My only point is I think there's a real rub there. But I think the other point that you make that is an excellent point is that we also have to look, is that alternative sentence reasonable or constitutional? I don't think it is. I think when you strip away the ACC designation, what you see is that we have to recalculate the guidelines, right? That's the lodestar pursuant to Supreme Court case law. So when you do that on both Mr. Boas's and Mr. Harlow's cases, you see a whole world of difference. Mr. Harlow's guidelines goes from 63 to 78 months, if not all the way down to 33 to 41 months. The government hasn't disputed this. They haven't even really engaged this analysis because I think it really takes the wind out of their sails that somehow the judge would have done it all over again.
The district court, you said it reduced the term of supervised release from 5 to 3. Did it restructure the sentence so that it became a constitutional sentence on the gun count?
It's a wonderful observation, Your Honor, and no. In both cases, they did not. So, for example, Mr. Boas's case, it's quite literally still a sentence in excess of the statute. Now, could have the district court sentenced him to the same sentence, 190 months? Yes, but right now what he is serving is two terms of 190 months, which is above the 120 ceiling. So to resentence him to 190, he would have to do 85 on one count, 85 on two count, on the second count, and then run it consecutive. That wasn't done. So I think that's problematic.
Now, well, it wasn't done. You mean the district court didn't articulate it or the government didn't argue it? I mean, when a district court says, you know, if I was required to resentence, I would do the same sentence, and accurately perceives that that would be an available option. We don't require every jot and tittle litany, do we? So where's the error here? I guess it's a procedural error or sub. I know you're saying at the bottom line is substantively unreasonable, but where's the procedural flaw?
Well, I think I have two thoughts. First, Mr. Boaz's case, he did not make that finding. He was still under.
No, I understand.
Right.
I think this is a Harlow-specific question.
Okay. The harm is in Mr. Harlow's sentence is that.
But the procedural. I mean, Judge Kelly asked a procedural question and did somebody march through the sentencing calculation that you would have to do without the ACCA, and you said no, and Mike, well, okay, where's the procedural error in that? Who had to do what?
Well, I think...
Other than the district court stating its bottom line and defense counsel not saying, well, how do you get there?
Right. I think what you have to do under the, such cases like Molina Martinez, it's the lodestar, the guidelines. So if you get to 33 to 41 months, which I think is a very plausible outcome, you then need to look and see, well, is 188 months still a reasonable sentence? And what the government has argued is, for example, on count two, he failed to appear and pled guilty to that. The judge sentenced him to 8 months. In doing so, the judge said, well, that's required, and it's a problem. He didn't seem excited about it. So the notion, what the government's now arguing, is that 8-month sentence can become a 180-month sentence. I don't see how that's reasonable. And so I think that's both procedurally and substantively prejudicial. But I think there's a bigger problem is that, you know, both of them were sentenced to very lenient ACCA sentences, almost the bare minimum under the statute. So they are now going from the most lenient sentence to extremely punitive sentences, and to do so when you're no longer a violent felon, I think there's a rub. And the only way I think the government can get to that result is by relying on the Olten case. The Olten case, of course, is a case that was handed down 4 years ago. It's not published, therefore it's not binding on this court. And it hasn't been cited to by this court since it was handed down 4 years ago, and I think for good reason. Olten, let me just start off, I think is factually distinguishable from this case. In the Olten case, the defendant was sentenced originally to the top of the guidelines because the district court, quote, viewed the facts as extreme and believed a longer sentence was appropriate due to the threat he posed to the community, end quote. So that's not the case here. Both Mr. Boaz and Mr. Harlow were on the low end of the guidelines and almost the statutory minimum. But I think the other thing about Olten is that it's just legally distinct. That was not dealing with a due process claim like Johnson. And the Supreme Court has held that as a distinction with the difference here, that, quote, condemning someone to prison for 15 years to life does not comport with the Constitution's guarantee of due process. That's Johnson. Olten, I also think, is problematic in that the singular concern expressed in that case was whether the same sentence could be reimposed.
Putting it in different words, I hear you making the Johnson-Beckles diversion or distinction should apply to Olten versus this case.
That it makes it distinct. Yes, Johnson, I think, makes it categorically distinct.
And right. Of course, Sunbear is limited to a guidelines problem.
Absolutely, Your Honor. I think it's a very astute observation. And I think Sunbear was also really grounded in some pragmatic concerns of interpreting the guidelines, and that the same sentence was within the unenhanced guidelines range and below the statutory maximum. So I think Sunbear helps us So I think the other thought that about Olten is the same sentence cannot be imposed in its totality. And we cite to a district court case, and I know that's not binding. I do think it's persuasive that when the logic of Olten doesn't apply in full fashion, which it doesn't here in either case, it doesn't apply because of the supervised release term. So you can't just reimpose the same sentence. I think we need to send it back then. And I think that's a proper procedure here, is to send it back.
Well, that's not Harlow, but in Harlow he corrected the supervised release, right?
Correct, Your Honor.
In Boas it didn't, because he didn't remove the ACCA.
Absolutely, Your Honor. Absolutely.
So with Harlow, I don't see that the presence of the supervised the need for a supervised release relief correction that the district court did requires a remand if the alternative sentence is sound.
And I think that's a fair point. My only point is in this other case, the Bradley case, a similar thing had to occur. And the district court said, well, while I'm modifying your supervised release term, I'm also going to give you a sentencing hearing. So I think the proper procedure here is to remand both cases, first to calculate the guidelines, right? See where we're at. That's the lodestar. And my expectation is that there's a substantial likelihood that both defendants would get within
guidelines. Well, in Boas, I need you to you say there's no Arizona case to the contrary of your argument, and then Waring was not cited by a P-second, but I went and found it, and it's a pretty good cite by the government.
And tell me which one that is.
Doesn't solve the question, but I think in the way these issues are resolved in terms of looking at state law, and Waring, so plus I would think the facts of Neal suggest that Arizona may never have used this statute in a way that didn't involve a use or threatened use of force.
Right.
So what's wrong with that in way of looking at it?
Right. I think there's three issues that why I don't think the Arizona conviction for exhibiting a weapon is a violent felony. The first is, I think we cite to pretty good circuit court case law that demonstrates that it relies that if it were to fall under the ACCA, it'd be under the void residual clause. The Long case from the Ninth Circuit, that it lacks the element of use, attempted use, or threatened use of physical force. It doesn't satisfy the force clause. Second issue.
What was the year of Long? Was it post Johnson?
I'm trying to remember.
We use the residual clause all the time. When we're having to re-examine.
Fair enough, Your Honor.
Typically, post sentencing, post conviction, after Johnson.
I think it's a fair point.
Is Long really that powerful? If it was pre-Johnson and they just used the residual clause, I wouldn't find that very probative, Frank, on this question.
They did make the express finding, though, that it didn't satisfy the force clause.
Was the Arizona statute materially different than the Missouri statute that we've held did qualify under the force clause?
Good question, Your Honor. I think it is different because the Arizona statute does say any manner, right, when it is in the context of unlawful use of a weapon during a fight or a quarrel. The Missouri offense, in contrast, requires an angry or threatening manner. There's no alternative means. So I think that's a distinction with a difference, especially when you turn to Arizona case law, the Pierce case, where the Arizona court, which I think we need to defer to, concluded that, quote, the purpose of the statute is to make punishable acts which endanger or
Doesn't the Arizona require a threatening manner?
If you look at 13-916, there's, I think, two ways it can be done, because there's an or there. And let me just read you what I have as the statute. A person who, not necessary of self-defense, in the presence of another, draws or exhibits any deadly weapon in threatening manner, or who, in any manner, unlawfully uses the weapon in a fight or quarrel, and then it keeps on going on. So I'm focusing on the or, who in any manner unlawfully uses the weapon in a fight or a quarrel. And I'm not
so
seeing...
Give me an example of something like that, that in a fight or a quarrel that would qualify. Give me a manner that wouldn't be violent or a threat of violence.
There's actually a case, an Arizona case, the Neal case. There was a threat going on. It was like after-school threat. And the defendant's brother was getting beat up. And so the defendant goes down to a ravine. He gets a gun.
I don't think you're right on the facts.
Okay.
I think that's a force clause situation. Even the fact that, yeah, that he went down in the ravine but then he shoots in the air and I don't think that's an example of an Arizona case that isn't within the force clause.
Fair enough, Your Honor. My position on the facts is that he was trying to disperse the crowd. So I don't know if he's trying to be angry or threatening or if he's trying to assist his brother. But I understand your position. Thank you.
Mr. Kelleher.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Jim Kelleher, appearing on behalf of the United States government. Before the court this morning are two cases involving defendants who were originally sentenced under the Armed Career Criminal Act. After Johnson, however, the government acknowledges that Glenn Harlow is no longer to be an armed career criminal, but remains legally subject to the sentence legally imposed by the district court. It remains the position of the government that Thomas Boaz remains subject to the provisions of the Armed Career Criminal Act. Inasmuch as Mr. Boaz's case does not share the common theme of Olten, I will address that case first. Under Arizona law, opposing counsel.
Before we get there, you would concede there's not an alternative sentence option in Boaz?
No, there is. There is.
Wait a minute. Under our jurisprudence of when we would affirm, because the district court made clear an alternative sentence ruling, we don't have that here. So if the ACCA doesn't apply, we have to remand because of the supervised release question.
You would certainly have to do it because of the supervised release violation.
Okay.
Yes, you are correct.
I can't see any reason not to simply remand for resentencing, given the district court has not signaled here.
It would
impose the same sentence. Obviously, you'll argue for it if it goes there.
Okay.
So then go ahead with the Boaz.
With regard to his status as an armed career criminal, Your Honor, Judge Grunder, I think, made a very good point. The Arizona statute is almost completely indistinguishable from the Missouri statute that this court has repeatedly found to be a violent felony under the force clause. Joseph Pulliam, which I feel like I've been litigating now for the last decade, has been repeatedly affirmed by this court. Most recently, I believe, in Hudson. And I would point out that in this court's first decision in Mr. Boaz's case, the court pointed out that the Arizona statute, the Arizona offense, includes as an element the exhibition of a deadly weapon in a threatening manner. It would appear that the original Boaz opinion found that the Arizona statute does fall under the force clause, and I would respectfully submit for this panel to find otherwise would require it to overrule that earlier panel decision, the Johnson case is notwithstanding. I think quite clearly with regard to the Arizona crime, we do have a force clause offense. I would note that the case cited by opposing counsel was decided in 1995. It is an unpublished opinion. And the quote that opposing counsel used, that is that the crime lacked the element of use, attempted use, and the court goes on, thus, according to Long, their conviction does not satisfy the categorical analysis approach for the purpose of Section 924E. The court then writes, we disagree, and then they get into a residual clause analysis, and quite clearly they decided Long under the residual clause.
Let's forget Long. But state law analysis, particularly after Mathis, has become much more significant and difficult. So you cite Waring.
I do.
And I found would help to cite the P second, but we found it. It quotes the statute in 1973. It did not have the or in any manner clause, and I don't know whether it was just quoting the relevant part of the statute relevant to Waring or whether the statute's changed. So I assume you've run that down. So, and it goes into Judge Grunder's question: how long has there been any distinction between the statutes?
I don't think there.
When was the Arizona statute last amended?
That I can't say. I know that it no longer exists. And conducting my final review before appearing for the court, that statute is no longer where it is now.
Did you track down its history? Its legislative amendment history?
I did not, Your Honor. But I can tell you that even with the quarrel clause, again, I don't think there's any meaningful difference between Missouri's unlawful use of a weapon statute and Arizona's, even if you include that additional.
Well, in any manner certainly allows creative lawyers to come up with a far broader range of hypotheticals that might conceivably be prosecuted, and then we have to search the Arizona case law to see whether that's ever happened.
And I have. I've looked at Arizona case law as best I could, and I couldn't find a case in candor to the court that would suggest that this crime is not committed in a manner identical to the way that is committed in the state of Missouri under the Pulliam analysis. So I don't think it's possible to find that this is anything other than a violent felony under the force clause. And consequently, at least in terms of Mr. Boaz's case, I don't believe we even get into the Olton Sunbear issue. That said, I'll delve into that now. Section 2255 was intended to afford federal prisoners a remedy identical in scope to federal habeas corpus.
Well, in Harlow, I guess yes, you're flipping to Harlow then, since you say it doesn't apply to Boaz.
Yes.
In Harlow, I didn't see in the government's brief any response to the Sunbear-Olton arguments that were raised. The government waived that?
No, I'm on page 15, we address Sunbear, and on page 17, we address Olton. And it's the government's position that given the nature and circumstances of the sentence, that is, that the sentencing judge sentenced Mr. Harlow to 180 months for being a felon in possession of a firearm under the provisions of the Armed Career Criminal Act.
The district court didn't, the particular 188 months exceeds the statutory maximum on every count that's there, right?
The mandatory minimum for the felon in possession, the armed career criminal, would be 180 months. So that technically is the mandatory minimum sentence if Mr. Harlow was deemed to be an armed career offender.
He's not.
We have conceded that, Your Honor.
Okay, so now?
So now the statutory maximum is 10 years.
And so he can't be given 188 months on a count that's 120 months. Maximum.
That is correct. However,
isn't that a problem?
It is not. Under essentially what we have with
Did the district court actually stack it the way you're talking? 120 months on this, 60 months on that, 8 months on this?
No. In the initial sentence, it was 180 months, followed by 4 years for failing to appear, followed by an additional 4 years for essentially an enhancement for failure to appear, for a total sentence of 188 months, which was a guideline sentence, and it was actually at the high end of the guidelines. Contrary to the assertion of opposing counsel, this was not the statutory minimum sentence. The court could have imposed a lesser sentence even at that time, but chose not to. During the argument, I asked for a sentence at the high end of the guidelines. The court concluded that was the appropriate sentence and fashioned a sentence as such. It's the position of the government that once you eliminate the armed career criminal designation, what you're posed with essentially is a guideline determination. The defendant quite clearly could still be sentenced to 188 months, and Judge Whipple made it very clear that he would have imposed the same sentence regardless of that designation.
Have you ever seen a case like that where, let's say, the guidelines was, according to opposing counsel, was somewhere in the 30 to 40 months, failure to appear, and that it was as high as 188, where the court actually stacked? Because I think we have to look at kind of as a practical matter. You've got an unconstitutional sentence on the one count. Is it sure the court could have? Have you ever seen a district court impose a sentence like that?
I don't think I've ever been faced with anything even remotely approaching the facts and circumstances of this particular case. Mr. Harlow.
Not procedurally. I mean, just sort of out the get-go. I've got a felon in possession that's a max of 10 years, and I've got a failure to appear, and I've got the enhancement for the failure to appear. So the gun case is about a 3-year, but I can go as high as 10 plus 5 plus 5, and I'm thinking maybe 188.
Again, I've certainly never seen a case like that, but I don't think I've ever been posed with that particular scenario. And in fact, in thinking about that question, Your Honor, I believe that the only two individuals who have ever failed to appear are Mr. Harlow and Mr. Boas. And
I've got one in the back of my mind where I remember I disagreed with Judge Richard Donald. It wasn't like this, but I think it was a Pierce vindictive sentencing problem where on remand the district court had done some elaborate stacking to get where it started, and that was argued it was vindictive, and well, no, it wasn't.
And we
argued about whether that was vindictive because it required stacking in order to get vindictive sentences higher than the original.
But this would have
been lower without some creative stacking, so that strikes me as somewhat comparable. Of course, here we're talking about the judge saying what the court would do,
right?
If
and Your Honor, I think that sentence for Mr. Harlow, 188 months, is not unreasonable. I went back and I looked at his pre-sentence report and I looked at the sentencing transcript. Mr. Harlow's got an awfully extensive criminal history. I noted at some point that he had like 77 violations when he was in the confines of the Department of Corrections.
Well, what about the fact that this is now an unconstitutional sentence? It's not a statutory change in what's a crime of violence or a violent felony. This is a constitutionally infirm sentence. Does that change how we have to look at what the district court can now do or what we can affirm in what they did when it was unconstitutional?
In looking at Sunbear, which is a guideline sentence, but interestingly, Sunbear was decided when the guidelines were mandatory. So the sentence imposed by the district court was essentially the mandatory minimum under the mandatory guidelines.
But here we do have a constitutional problem, right? Isn't that the distinction? Or a distinction?
And that's I failed to articulate it well, but that's what you didn't address in your brief, that Sunbear and Olten are distinguishable because here the underlying error is a constitutional error. That wasn't addressed in your briefs.
Okay. I guess the point we try to make in our brief is that the government's argument is essentially the sentence imposed on Mr. Harlow is part of a package. And yes, part of that package has now been changed to a certain extent. But the overall sentence itself, 188 months, is still a constitutionally sound, a statutorily authorized sentence. There's nothing unconstitutional about the imposition of 188 months on Mr. Harlow. The fact that one of the underlying crimes within that package, the statutory minimum has been reduced, is of no consequence ultimately when you look at the overall sentence. The sentence itself is constitutionally sound. 188 months for the two crimes falls within falls far below the statutory maximum sentence that Judge Whipple could have imposed.
I suspect you could find some, we all could find some double jeopardy jurisprudence where the fact that double jeopardy is a constitutional infirmity did not limit or restrict or the resentencing options, so long as the double jeopardy problem was properly eliminated.
That I can't speak
well,
to.
No, I mean, of course, double jeopardy jurisprudence is about as complicated as you get, but there's a lot of resentencing that the double jeopardy clause is required.
It does.
And just to say it's a constitutional infirmity, I don't think affects
it is.
What can be done to fix it.
And again, I think in this case, ultimately Judge Whipple has made his intent very clear that Mr. Harlow will receive the same sentence, regardless of how the guidelines are ultimately calculated. This case has been litigated extensively over the years. Judge Whipple is clearly familiar with the case. He's clearly familiar with the arguments made by both parties. And he opted at the end of the day to state that even if all of these other issues are resolved adversely to the government's position, at the end of the day, even if this panel were to remand it, Mr. Harlow will still be sentenced to 188 months. And it remains the position of the government that that is a reasonable sentence predicated upon the facts and circumstances of this case and his nature and characteristics. I see my time's up. Thank you.
Judge, I have a few points if I could just take a couple minutes. Thank you, Your Honor.
First, turning to Mr. Boas briefly, I think it's important to note that I don't think the Boas panel on direct appeal was clear that they're relying on the force clause or the residual clause. They cited to the Jackson case, which then in turn relied on the residual clause. There are two other issues on the Boas case that a certificate of appealability was not granted, and we're deferring to that. But I would point out that one of those crimes was an Arizona third degree burglary. So with that, I'm going to turn to Harlow and quickly note that Sumbear actually was decided in 2011. So I don't think the guidelines were mandatory. But more importantly...
No, I think when the initial sentence was...
I get what you're saying. Okay, fair enough.
That's my recall of it.
Fair enough, Your Honor. But the same sentence, let's say the district court just does want to sentence him to the same sentence. Fair enough. Then and only then, I think the issue's fairly teed up for this court for review, and it's not ripe yet. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Appreciate your efficient efforts to do a two-for-one, but cover both properly and adequately, and we'll take them under advisement.